This is a Collider.com audio interview.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Yourself?
I'm doing excellent.
Did you go to the Iron Man double bill at the Hero Complex thing?
I had a badge for the entire Hero Complex, so I went every single night.
Who was the special guest or special surprise at the Iron Man thing?
It was Jon Favreau. Hold on, let me shut off my cell phone. It was Jon Favreau, and then after a few minutes, the surprise guest was Robert Downey Jr.
Woo-hoo!
So, in fact, I believe you know Mr. Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I got a little bit, yeah, sure.
Yeah, exactly. No, did you, you know, for the people who are just, because I post audio, for the people that are listening to this, we ran into each other at the Hero Complex. How did you end up at the, you were there for Superman?
No, I went there for
Star Trek.
I'm a big Star Trek fan. Went to go see Wrath of Khan, and then listen, I wanted to hear what the director had to say, then we stayed on for the 2009.
So how did you end up there? Did you hear about it? Did you read about it?
I'm friends with Greg Schwenk, who runs the Newport Beach Film Festival, and he goes to all those events. He goes to all the film festivals and everything, and he wanted to know if he wanted to go along. So I said, please.
So, what did you? Obviously, you've seen Wrath of Khan before. This is not the interview I expected. But where did you? Well, you've seen Wrath of Khan before. Is that your favorite, or did you just love JJ's version of Trek?
Wrath of Khan. I really enjoyed. There's a bunch of them I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the one where the Klingon moon blows up undiscovered country. I thought First Contact was fantastic. I just enjoy that whole sort of Star Trek thing. I'm a big Trekkie fan. And I was really interested to see those two movies next to each other because you can see what they borrowed from The Wrath of Khan. What they were going after in that one.
Yeah, I think both JJ's movie and Wrath of Khan are both, you know, phenomenal films.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of the old series and of the old characters and everything. So I'm a little bit the same way as, you know, the old Sean Connery James Bond issue. You know, for me it began and end with Sean Connery and stuff like that. But so for me, you know, although I love the Next Generation and Patrick Stewart and those guys, but I just felt that the dynamics between the characters were stronger for whatever reason. You know. On the first lot.
I understand.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, I will now leave you be on the Star Trek stuff and jump into the ward. So, I mean, the most basic, of course, is that how did you get involved and what was it like working for John Carpenter?
I got involved because through someone I used to know at college, Duke University, he runs the film company now, and we got in touch with each other, and then I came in and chatted with him, and he said, he had this thing, and would I be interested, and you know, they were out to some other people, for other actors, but it didn't look like it was going to work, and would it be something that I might be interested in? And I said, you know, I can say right now, hell yes, it's John Carpenter, but send me the script. So that's how I got involved, and are you there?
No, I'm totally listening.
Yeah, sorry, because you mentioned the phone issue, so I thought we were...
No.
And then, you know, I read the script, and it was good fun, and I could see it would be exactly how this worked and sort of being in a John Carpenter movie. You know, I love his films. I remember where I was when I saw in Precinct 13, the cinema. I was at the Odeon High Street, Ken. I remember going to see Halloween in the West End. I remember going to see The Thing in North Carolina when I was at Duke. You know, Starman on Times Square in New York. You know, I love his film.
I'm on the same page. Now, I have to ask you, you've obviously been in a ton of movies, you're involved in a lot of projects, but how long did it take for you to all of a sudden start being a little bit of a, you know, movie nerd slash geek and start asking, you know, John, you know, fan questions, if at all?
I think it's all right to ask questions like that. I mean, you know, he doesn't like to sit there and chit chat on set. So, if you were on your way to lunch or something like that, you'd sit and chat and talk about the other movies and some of the questions and famous stories that you know about these films and stuff like that. But when you're on set, he doesn't want to chit-chat. He wants any conversation to be about solving the problem of why you're not shooting the next shot. And I probably got to talk to him a little bit more about that after we were done, or when, you know, there was a couple of times we went out for dinner or we had a drink or something like that.
Yeah, I'm also a huge fan of Carpenter, and I don't know if I would be able to go the whole shoot without geeking out about, you know, They Live. I think that would be my number one talking about thing.
Yeah.
I really do. But talk a little bit about, with certain projects, when you're on a film, obviously when you first sign on, you know, the script might be one way, and then there's rewriting, characters change, things get adjusted. How much changed over the course of filming for your character on the project, if at all?
How much changed of the character?
Oh yeah, like the character's script, you know.
Yeah, not a lot. There were a few little. They were tightening up the story. You know, it's very difficult when you do a story like this without giving too much away. Where there's a sort of, you know, there's a big reveal at the end of the story, where there are necessarily. Then sort of holes in the story which you have to kind of, they're like thin ice and you just got to shoot over them quickly. You don't want to sort of linger over the bit where the ice is thin. And it's, you know, it's necessary for that way, because every single story of any movie that you've watched where you've had a good experience, I could probably sit down there and pull out bits where there are, you know, not logical inconsistencies, but there are, you know, they're kind of like reality gaps that are in there. But, you know, it is a story. They're fictions. So in this particular one, there was tightening up of stuff that was going on. And there was a few things that I suggested in terms of, very few things in terms of how my character could help with the, you know, the stronger an idea or a line you had over what this guy was up to, you felt that what he was up to, it would help us, even though in the end it turned out to be something completely different. So, and it added a little bit more mystery and stuff like that.
I understand. I'm going to move away from the window where they're doing all sorts of yard work, which is lovely for doing interviews on the phone.
I can hear the blowers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm going to jump into talking a little bit about what has the last few years been like for you? Obviously, you've been working as an actor for a very long time. However, in the last few years, it seems like, you know, you've landed some, I'm going to use the term, bigger roles or more high-profile projects. What's that been like for you as an actor, or as, you know, let me start with that.
Well, let's see. I mean, I used to do lots of independent films, and for a while I was very content living in New York City and doing independent movies and off-Broadway theatre, and I loved it. I had a really good time doing that, and I worked on a lot of projects that are very dear to my heart, both you know, plays and films. But it's it became clear to me that it was more and more so that the business was changing. You know, it used to be that you could do these nuggets of a movie, and people would there would be a kind of a it would attach itself in terms of credibility to your work and the style of work that you did, that people would be interested and curious about you and your work as an actor. But I think that with the whole sort of vertical integration of this business within the giant corporations, the bottom line became the only line, you know, and it was just about making money. And if you're not famous, you're not successful as an actor. So I realized that it became more and more, as the, you know, the independent world started to dry up, you couldn't, you know, the amount of money that you could make doing an independent film, it wasn't possible to sustain paying your rent and stuff like that. I realized that I needed to do more mainstream stuff so that I could, you know, I could still keep going as an actor. You have to increase your visibility within the business. So, and I've been lucky that I've been able to do that.
Well, I was going to say, switching, if you don't mind, talking a little bit about Mad Men for a second. Obviously, like many, many other people out there, Mad Men is one of my favorite shows. Could you sort of talk a little bit about being on that show and just the, you know, the fact that so many people seem to love it?
It is a great place to go to work. The set is a very egalitarian place. The crew are phenomenally talented. They very efficiently and effectively and at incredibly high standards managed to get through an enormous amount of material. They shoot 7 or 8 pages a day, and it's quality. The delivery of their work, Chris Manley's lighting, which is normally what happens on a film set, is to get a good image, it takes a while to light a set, you know, and that means that if you want to do that quickly, that, you know, there's a certain amount of time that it's going to take anyway, so or you have to have a crew that really understands one another, and this lot do. So, and then the challenge is on the actors. You're going to get through 7 or 8 pages a day. It's a lot of material, so you have to be ready, you have to have decided what you're going to do with the material, and you know, and then you beg for a third take.
I was going to ask you, obviously, with a show like that, which has such great dialogue and the quality of the scripts is so high, how much does Matthew and the other writers sort of pay attention to where you deliver each comma? Or is there a lot of flexibility for you as an actor to, you know, adjust the script to the way you want to deliver it? I guess, how collaborative is that process?
If it's in the script, if it's written in the script, you have to do it. If it says that you walk across the room and you pick up a bunch of flowers and chuck them out the window on a specific line, you do it on that line. If it says that you undo your top button and pull your tie off at a certain point in the script, you do it exactly at that point. I have been told by the continuity, the script supervisor, that I've left out commas before. It's very, very, very specific, and the idea is I'm probably, with good cause, imbued from his experience working on other projects, he's seen how the scripts can become a piece of plastic, and he wants his work to be respected. He wants the writer's work and the hours and hours and hours that they put into crafting the script, you know, the months that they put into it, he wants that to be respected. It is not going to be treated as a thing of Play-Doh, you know. And also what happens, I've noticed with actors, is they come up with a problem in a script. They see there's a moment in the script which they're not comfortable with. So what they'll do is they'll write that uncomfortableness out of the script. But, and what happens is everything becomes a bit flat. quite often, if there's something in a script which you don't feel comfortable with, it probably means that it's a good sign. It's something that's going to be asking you to reveal something about yourself that you're not comfortable with. It's going to be good for the drama and good for the character, and it's going to have that kind of rough texture to it, you know?
Absolutely. Cool. Could you talk a little bit about... I'm assuming, mind you, this is just me being stupid for a second. I'm assuming you're on the upcoming season.
I'm not sure what we can say about that,
Are you filming starting next month, Mad Men episodes?
We haven't been told yet. I know that they're writing. I assume that, as far as I know, I think everyone who was on last season is coming back, as far as I'm aware. But we haven't been told when we're starting yet. I do know that they've opened the writer's room and they are they're crafting scripts at the moment. And what Matt likes to do, as I understand it, he likes to, you hear on other shows and they'll open the writer's room for a month maybe and they'll get maybe two episodes in before they'll start shooting, and I think Matt likes to get like four or five under his belt so that he's that far ahead of the curve. So you're not just pumping them out and then, you know, shooting them right away.
I think that also is a testament to why the show is so good.
There are many things. You know, I don't think it's rocket science. I mean, in terms of if you want to give you let the creator create the show. You don't replace him. You don't try and get rid of him. And you give the writers a chance to do what they do best. You know, it's the one commodity that is in the most short supply in the film business is time. You know, but the more time, the better the quality will be, up to a point. But yeah, you know.
No, absolutely. I obviously will leave you alone on Mad Men, even though I could spend a lot of time asking you questions about that. If you don't mind, I will ask you.
After anything airs, I can talk about it, but I have no clue what's happening in the next season.
Oh, you know something?
I can't give anything away.
Oh, no.
About anything that happens and the stuff that we've already seen, because that's all I know.
I got to be honest with you. I'm such a fan of the show, I don't want to know what's coming up.
Right.
I just want to see it when it airs.
Right.
You know? But I do want to ask you, though, obviously you're in a very high-profile picture that's coming out later this year. Definitely have to ask you, how did you get involved in Sherlock Holmes?
I met Joel and Susan Downey in the summer, and there was interest at that point. I think there seems to be sort of two ways of going with it, and one was there was obviously, as there always is in this business, there was interest in them getting another star for the marquee, you know, and that's all these wonderful names are being batted around. And then there was another feeling that it might be best to have a character actor playing the role so that you just experience the character and you weren't looking at somebody going, oh look, there's somebody really famous playing the part. You know, they just wanted to experience the character. So there was a sort of a creative discussion that went on for quite a long time amongst the powers that be. And I was, it was in those sort of things of, you know, they're interested, it's gone away, oh, it might be coming back, oh, they're interested in again, oh, no, it's gone again. You know, that went on for a long time. And then I happened to be in Switzerland visiting a friend, and I suddenly got a phone call saying, if you can get to London tomorrow and meet Guy, you know, they're interested again. So I flew to London and auditioned for Guy.
I, as you may or may not know my opinion on this, I obviously think you're a fantastic choice for the character. I think I might have mentioned that to you in the past. I don't know where, though. But I definitely want to ask you...
The hero complex.
Yeah, exactly, the hero complex. I definitely want to ask, when you're playing a character like that is so iconic, that is known the world over, how much pressure do you put on yourself to research and see all the different ways it's been played in the past, or do you sort of try to stay away from all of that material to craft your own version?
Well, you want to craft your own version, but you've also, you need to be in the same genre of film as everybody else, and you want to stay true to, as they have with their series, to the spirit of Sherlock Holmes, whilst making the character into, it's a sort of it's kind of a superhero movie that's slightly in that genre of film. He doesn't have any superpowers except he's got a super intellect, in terms of the Sherlock Holmes character. So I did look at other stuff. I'm a fan of the Sherlock Holmes series. I used to watch them in the Bahamas with my father, every single one. Interestingly, Moriarty is a character who you certainly in the books you only meet him twice. And the description of the character physically, I wasn't tall enough and probably old enough for it. And also that part I didn't really want to do. I felt like there's another physical look to the character that would be more interesting. And also plus, it's been done. I forgot the guy's name, but they did it all verbatim from the Jeremy Beck Sherlock Holmes, and you can see it on YouTube. We went back and forth about trying to come up with a look, and I was given a lot of input into how I wanted to look. There was a certain amount of thrashing around in terms of the character itself, and with Robert and with Guy, and all the people involved in creating the series, Lionel. So I had some input into that, but I haven't been with the whole thing as long as they have. So, and it's very much a spontaneous thing to what happens when you get there on the day. So you can do all your preparation and be ready for everything, and then none of it's useful. So.
I totally understand. I'm actually a huge fan of, obviously, Robert's, and I loved the first Sherlock Holmes. Something that Robert talked about when promoting the first Sherlock, and also when he talks about Iron Man, is the way he is as an actor, where the morning that he's going to shoot something, he will always try to take the scene apart. He's admitted that basically he's very difficult, and that he's always constantly tinkering and stuff like that. Did you find that process with him sort of enjoyable? Was it challenging? Did it keep you on your toes?
Well, he's not difficult at all. I experienced him as being incredibly generous, very, very charming, incredibly accessible person. I genuinely have a great deal of affection for him. I admire his talent and his work. The style of working that you describe, it worked on the first one. So no one would argue with the fact that it worked. And for me, I understand that there's sort of two antithetical forces at work. And one of them is that from their side, from Robert and Guy's side, they want to tell a story in a way that you feel as though you haven't seen a story told like this before. Which means that they're right out on the edge. Now, there's a lot of money involved, and the people who are responsible for spending that money are constantly looking for ways to, quote-unquote, manage their risk. And the way that the conventional wisdom is for managing that risk is familiarity. And that's why they want movie stars that audiences are familiar with to be playing the leading roles. They want the story to be familiar, because then the audience knows what the kind of experience they're going to get. They want to tell you what the experience is, and they show you the whole movie in a 3-minute trailer, so that you see the trailer and you've pretty much seen the movie, and then you go to the film and then you see, you know, and that's a totally antithetical side to what it is from someone who's telling you a story. You know, you don't tell the person the punchline first and then give them the setup. So it's a totally antithetical way of approaching solving that problem. And I got it that what they wanted to do was be able to find a fresh way to present a scene and present it, and that meant taking out plot. Because what often you see happens is, and when in doubt in a lot of movies, just restate the plot. And if you don't have a good grip on character, characters don't reveal themselves. They just tell you what has happened, what is happening, or what is going to happen. And that's what they use for dialogue. And Robert and Guy tried to pull out as much plot an exposition as possible, because exposition is dull for an audience. You know, when you go and see a play, the first 20 minutes of a play, you find yourself, you know, tapping your feet, because the author is setting up the circumstances of his story, and it's called exposition, and you're watching exposition, and it isn't fantastically gripping as drama, you know. So they understand that, and they try and pull out exposition. And on the other side of it, there's a concern that the audience won't be following a story, especially one that is as complex and as many twists as a Sherlock Holmes story, and they worry about losing the audience, so they try and put more of it in. So, you know, there's an interesting little battle that goes on between the two of them, and I just watched and admired their skill at being able to tell a story as efficiently as they do.
I agree with you 100%, and a lot of us movie nerds understand the delicate balancing act of exposition and, you know, what's needed for the average moviegoer, and what movie nerds can... You succinctly said it very well.
You don't, I mean, the thing is, you don't need a lot of exposition. I mean, you look at... did you see that movie, The Prophet?
I did.
I mean, there's almost no exposition in that movie. You know, the guy arrives at the prison, you start with him in the van, arriving at the prison, he doesn't know anybody, you realize that this guy's got to survive or he's going to become somebody's lunch meat, and he's put in a situation where he's... And then, you know, the thing just snowballs from there, and you know, it's almost a silent movie, and it's gripping. It's absolutely gripping, and you understand what's going on the whole time.
I agree with you. A Prophet's just a phenomenal film.
Yeah.
I definitely want to ask you, and I know I'm running out of time or abusing how much time I was supposed to get with you, but what was it like filming... I mean, as a movie fan, as someone who grew up with movies all around you, what was it like to film Sherlock Holmes in and around London? I mean, that had to be, honestly, just a real thrill.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you know, it was nice to be back in London and have a job. You know, when I was there, my career, I established myself really in America, and and when I went back to England, when I was married, I struggled when I was there, because I'd been away for such a long time, and all the people who knew me and knew my work were back in America, either in New York or Los Angeles. So, I had a tough time of it while I was there. So it was great to be back there and be working.
I'm going to switch gears completely and say I also really enjoyed your work on Fringe, which is actually one of my favorite shows. Can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in that show? And talk a little bit about how you got involved and what it was like making it, if you don't mind.
Not at all. I personally am a conspiracy theory junkie. I love them. I'm fascinated by them. This just ticks so many boxes that were perfect for me in terms of the sort of the science fiction, the conspiracy theory, the there's more at work. There are forces at work controlling our destiny and all that kind of stuff. I loved it all. I got a phone call through my agent saying that they were interested and, you know, they'd like me to come and do it. Would I read the script and decide just that one episode? And I read it, and I knew the show. I'd seen it being promoed. I knew I was going to watch it already. It appealed to me. I got on the phone with Jeff Pinkner and discussed a little bit that he could tell me about the character. And I was kind of funny because I got to the set and he'd revealed things about where this guy was going and what was happening and what he was up to. And when I got to the set, I actually knew more than the other people. They told me more than they told them, and it was the stars of the show, you know.
That's very, very, very funny.
So I loved it. And you know, if I've spoken to Jeff and about it and about the show, and of course, I was extremely disappointed about the way my character ended up. I never really saw that as. I never saw that being his problem, that character's problem. And I have to say, going back to what we were talking about before, about trying to do things in ways that are different, I've noticed that in Goldman's bad guys, they're all very similar in that they've all got a major daddy issue. And that is their main motivating force, is they have a personal issue with not being appreciated or wanting to prove themselves to whoever their father figure is in the story. And I just find the repetition of it has got tedious to me. And in a way, there's also, it's another thing which is going back to playing what you're asking about the Moriarty and also about playing villains in general, is, and about the interface of what we're talking about before, about plot and exposition and stuff like that. Don't tell them anything. Iago is one of the great villains of all time. There is no explanation for why he does what he does. None. And the people are fascinated by the evil, quote unquote evil, because it's mysterious and it doesn't seem to have a rationale behind it. And the second that you say that Hannibal Lecter was abducted as a child and he had to eat his sister or something like that, it becomes immediately mundane. The character becomes mundane. Don't explain. That's what's fascinating about it.
I agree with you, and it's sort of what JJ does with, like, what's inside the box. The less you know, the more the audience is forced to think about it themselves, I think is a much better experience for everyone.
I agree. I mean, there's certain things that you need to know going forward because you don't want the audience to get left behind. But in terms of in terms of your villain, you need to know what the villain's doing. Why the villain's doing what they're doing? I don't think that's important. Alan Rickman played a very, very good villain in Die Hard, and it wasn't until almost towards the end of the story that you discovered that he was actually just trying to rob the place, but you thought there was something else at work. And the longer that you don't know what they're up to, the better it is. Once you unpack the bad guys, what he's up to, the interest in the bad guy diminishes immediately.
I agree with you. I think most movie fans would agree that Alan Rickman in Die Hard as one of the best all-time movie villains?
Great. He got good humor into it, and he and that's another case of guys coming up with stuff on the spot, because that whole scene where he goes and does the bit with the doing the accent actually came about because he was doing his American accent on set, and they went, wait, you can do an American accent, I wonder if we could use that. And they wrote that scene in after they were shooting, you know, when they started shooting already.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I, of course, this is my last Sherlock Holmes question. Does your Moriarty think he's a bad guy, or is he just, does he know he's evil, or not at all?
I think that for me, and, you know, this is, again, my rationale, it's never explained in the story, or because I don't really think it needs to be, but for me, I think that the whole concept of the character's amoral, he's moved beyond that the concept of there being a heaven and a hell and a god and the devil and there being good and evil. He doesn't believe in it. And if you don't believe in that moral construct, then everyone is free to do whatever they want. And he sees that whole approach to viewing the world, life, and everything around them as being a childish construct. So he doesn't believe in the whole idea of there being good and evil. So he couldn't conceive himself as being either good or evil. He's just doing what's good for him. You know, it's like asking if you're a fish, how could a fish conceive of space? You know, you swim in the water that you swim in, or the atmosphere that you're in. For him, he just doesn't exist. That whole idea doesn't exist.